Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Mujan Soni. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for joining. And Mujan, I sent you a quick note that we got in our suggestion box. It's one of the two ways, or many ways, I think it's in many of the episode sidebars. And I think it was a friend of yours, Jacob, sent a nice message over saying, hey, I listened to episode 1109 on planned obsolescence. And he fairly recognized that we focused on the design part, just make it more reliable. Although there's a whole nother episode there, because I just saw in the news that the Microsoft is pretty much shutting down support for Microsoft Office 10, I think it is, or operating system, whatever it was, after, 10, 15 years? And so no more updates and all this other stuff. And there's computers that are not able to update to 11. So they're becoming obsolete and at risk for, you know, security breaches and stuff like that. But that's a whole nother topic. Back to Jacob. He said, let me paraphrase a bit of it, part of his conversation is even though you're working on how reliability can be built into products up front, and this is a quote, I think another interesting conversation is whether and when companies should allow aftermarket to take up maintenance for themselves, and by providing technical information or just simply getting out of the way. And I think he's talking to the right to repair, which is becoming much more common in different jurisdictions and areas of the world. But, you know, you got some time to talk about that today?
Yes, that sounds great. And it's wonderful to get feedback from our listeners. Thank you, Jacob, for your comment and suggestion on the topic.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I know Kirk often talks about. It is a lot of electronics, it works way beyond when the company wants you to buy their latest, greatest version of it. And I don't know if Kirk still has it, but he had an iPhone 6 the last time I talked to him, and it was doing just what it needs to do for him. And it was just fine. I think he replaced the battery at one point, and that was it, which is a whole lot less expensive than buying a new iPhone. But when I first got into electronics with Hewlett Packard, they were making test and measurement equipment that went into laboratories and bench tops and all kinds of cool stuff for all kinds of people. And they typically made products that would last 15 to 20 years. And these were as complicated or more complicated than an iPhone. And some were handheld even. The electronics itself is not the limiting factor for electronics type products. And I know you know of mechanical systems. I'm thinking of the old steam engines, you know, big clunky and lots of iron, but they still run if you take care of them. So it seems one way to keep your equipment running and that you like it and keep using it is to be able to get the parts for it and to repair it or, you know, that kind of stuff. It just makes common sense to me. Yet there's a pushback from industry saying, well, then you don't buy the new one. Well, so it seems to be a conflict there.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, like, of course, the number of units that if I'm in charge of forecasting and I'm coming up with a new product, and, you know, trying to figure out the price point for it and, you know, what's my volume going to be and, you know, planning all my production and stuff. Just to play devil's advocate, to be fair to the companies, it would make it kind of challenging to do all of that. If you also are trying to basically take into account the fact that the previous revision of the product is you know also going to be in the field for longer and people may repair it. And but to be fair, I think that it probably would be an iterative exercise, right? Like it would be new for a while, but after a while, you should have enough data to be able to predict, okay, like what portion is it? Is it what's realistic to expect in terms of like the portion of your customer base that would go through the effort of repairs and such? And you know how to plan for that in terms of you know parts and allowing you know third parties to do repairs and what to take into account for your design and such like and such things.
Well, some industries do this and are trying to take some of the right to repair away. The auto industry for a century has they make money on the aftermarket sales. They you know they know that other people are going to create spare parts for them. So they got into the business of doing that. And these are factory approved or factory first, you know, or whatever they call it. And I remember working on a car that was a 1969 Oldsmobile. And the shop I was, you know, renting space from to work on it, it had the manual. It had every nut and bolt and detail and every tool I needed. It was all there. And plus there was a mechanic that was looking over my shoulder, just kind of, well, encouraging me would be the right word to say.
Yes.
I had no idea what I was doing. But now I look under the hood and you need a computer to do anything. And I know John Deere got in trouble because just to run a diagnostic on a John Deere combine, for example, required going back to a dealer, and combines don't travel well on the freeway. they just don't. And if they're not running, they're not working, then you can't get there. And so they finally sued John Deere, some farm association of some sort, and says, hey, we can't afford to drive 200 miles for you to tell us that we need a new chip in here. We need ways to bypass that or do it ourselves or do other systems so that we can keep this equipment running when we need it. And so I don't know what the current state is of that lawsuit and what they did about it, but the auto industry has gotten, it's basically a computer on wheels. And so, yeah, having a diagram of it's just not going to be enough. I can put the change oil and replace wheels, but that's about it.
Yes. I'm going to play devil's advocate just one more time. Sure. I think the idea behind having computers on wheels, I think, is partially intended to be that you don't have to think about any maintenance. In fact, I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day. Someone asked me, I think recently, that how did you take into account, you know, maintenance into your reliability test planning in automotive? Mm-hmm. And I responded, I was like, well, I've only worked on EVs and there is no maintenance. So we did it. So basically when you're thinking about the reliability of the product, you're designing it for, I think, again, it goes back to kind of a discussion that we had in the other episodes. You know, how long should you design it for to last? But based on the best, you know, knowledge and engineering judgment and market analysis, et cetera, that you have, you design it for a given number of years. And the idea is that then, you know, your components within your product are supposed to meet that requirement. So, and the other thing that I'll say is that I know that, you know, I've spent lots of time and others I know have also spent lots and lots of time. There's many hours of discussions that go into reducing cases like the one that you mentioned for with the John Deere example, which is this is called like vehicle off-road, mm-hmm. which means that essentially you're in a case where the user is has had an issue and they have to pull over. And what that means is that they cannot necessarily, you know, drive to a service center. They have to they pull over. Of course, this is a terrible situation, right? Like, because it's of course like like, you know, can have implications around, you know, like, are they somewhere where they can safely pull over? Of course, just from user experience is terrible and such. So this is a metric that is sometimes actually used to ensure that, you know, to track and ensure that changes are made. So, you know, we fix the problems that are causing vehicle off-road situations such that they don't become, you know, that we can reduce it as much as possible, because the idea is to have the customer have a delightful experience for the whole time of they have that they have the product, and, you know, reduce the time that they need to go to service at all, or that they have any issues where they can't even necessarily, like, you know, use the product. So at least from my experience for in the EV market, which is, you know, a different model because there's no dealerships, from at least for the, in my experience, the companies that I've worked at.
there is a Tesla shop in Las Gatos now.
Oh, there yes. Yeah. But that's true. Center. Yeah. There are some repair centers, but for the most part, the idea is that, you know, for service, like this, the service centers are owned by Tesla and the service centers are owned by Rivian. This is all part of the same, you know, infrastructure.
But it's not a third party group.
It's not a third party. Exactly. It's not a third party. So I think that the idea is that then, you know, so that data is fortunately captured, and then you can really use that to drive, you know, drive. So, and because of that model, the incentive, at least in that model, is to reduce service because you're carrying the cost of it yourself as well. Which means,
But I'm thinking of that old Oldsmobile I had a push button radio and no cassette thing in it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody made a 8-track tape for inside a car. Maybe somebody did, but the radio element of it fit into a socket essentially that you could pull out. And you could slide in a new updated radio or an upgraded sound system. And they even had chases for the wires if you wanted to add speakers to it. Whereas my car today, you know, we have I don't know, 4 or 5 year old Subaru in our driveway. And there's no way I could get that radio out and update it with something else off the shelf.
Yes,
you know, it's just true. Built into the console. It's all a computer, and it's you know, it's like, so part of it is not just I want to be able to change the water pump, or, you know, and I don't think it's safe for a layperson to change the batteries on their EV, but I should be able to diagnose it and change the computer chips that were, you know, a handful of other parts, the air cabin filters, the whatever it is. But if I do have a problem with, and I had a Toyota that had a screen on it, and it was horribly expensive for GPS, the map feature of it. So I just used my phone instead. But the screen, half of it went blank. And I know what that is. There's a driver circuit here, and it's probably got a loose connection or it's a bad chip. But there was no way I could get to it to diagnose it any further without disassembling the entire console. Luckily, it was under warranty and they took care of it. Yet it was one of those things that, well, maybe I'm showing my age. I miss the old days when I could pretty much do any maintenance on my vehicle and keep it running. And yeah, I live in a San Francisco Bay Area. There's plenty of options, mechanics, and all kinds of stuff that I take advantage of. Yet if I'm in the middle of, say, the Sierra someplace, and it's 200 miles to the nearest dealer, I'm out of luck. Especially if I can't drive. That's an expensive tow.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is a very expensive tow. Yeah. I totally agree. I've had a similar experience, actually, like, funny anecdote on this topic. My car is a 2015 Mitsubishi, and it was the last, I think it was the last model to be made before Android Auto and Apple CarPlay became available. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have Android Auto and Apple CarPlay on my car, but of course it's so convenient to have those, right? And I spent some time earlier this year trying to figure out how do I can I just like update the software on my car? Like the hardware on the car can probably run it.
Right.
You know, it's only a year difference. So I don't imagine that they suddenly had to change. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't imagine they suddenly had to change the, you know, the boards on in the car and the display settings and all that to and the hardware for this for the display to be able to suddenly, you know, be able to run Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. So we reached out to Mitsubishi and I was like, can I just update the software? I'm like, I'll pay for it. Like, I just want to be able to have, to use the display with one of those options. And they were like, no, we don't do that.
No, they want you to buy a new car so you have a better sound system.
but yes, I mean, to your point, I'm probably not, like, I don't think my car is only like, I mean, it's not super old. It's not super new. It's not super, super old. I'm not going to buy another car just for the display, right? Like, so I ended up getting like a little, like, you know, like a plug-in little display that I just mount on the dash.
Yeah. Just work around it and it's cheaper.
Yeah, I worked around it. Exactly. And it was, you know, much, much cheaper than buying a new car. So yes, it would have been really like things like that, I think would have been very, like from a user perspective.
Well, I know from the manufacturers and the design teams, it's, you know, how do we integrate this? How do we make it a nice, simple supply chain, although nothing's simple in vehicles or computers or phones anymore. Yet any product is like, for example, I have an inkjet printer and I've had it, geez, over 10 years, probably close to 15 years. And I know, because I worked with the team that made these printers, is they're really only designed to last 5 years, but they don't want any to fail at 5 years. So it's like 99% reliable at 5 years is part of their design target. And they tend to last. They are robust little machines that if you don't drop them, they're going to just keep on doing what they do. But the one I got was it uses ink that's in cartridges that doesn't have a print head on it. So they're just reservoirs of ink. And the print head is built into the printer. And so you change cartridges that don't have the expensive little nozzle or nozzles on it. But the designers of this said, you know, this will work for like 15, 20, maybe more ink cartridge replacements. But eventually the print head itself is going to wear out. And so that's two easy to use latches and that whole cartridge assembly comes right out. And for about $40, you can get a new cartridge and stick it right in, put your ink cartridges back in it and you're off and running. And it was way cheaper than buying a new printer, which then would have probably not been compatible with the ink cartridges I have. And so that's where the loss of money would be. But they knew that there's a lifetime to that. And the same with iPhones, is there is a lifetime to the batteries. And so like Kirk did is he went in and had him change out the battery. He was upset that he couldn't do it himself. He's technically savvy enough that he could. Yet Apple, at that time when he did it, changed the battery, they would not provide the tooling to open the case of the phone, nor supply the spare parts unless you were in an Apple store or Apple repair center. And so I think they've loosened up on that some. Yet it's that right to repair is inherently a conflict between the design ability to create these really cool functionality and integrate it into the systems and so on. And I bet you on your car, there's probably some Apple and Android security protocol and chip that they wanted to have. I bet you there's some extra hardware that goes with that. Yet you would think it would be just a cartridge, plug it in, plug it out, and you're off and running with the new system. But I don't think there aren't that many products I know of that anticipate future updates and then make it easy to do.
Yeah. You know, I'm so curious. It would be very, very interesting to see data on what percentage of customers would be willing to go through the repairs themselves.
Oh, I would. Oh, definitely.
Yes. Yeah. I know you would. I can't say that I would. Well, it depends. I think it depends on what it would be. Like if it's something for me, it would be, you know, it would need to be something that is very efficient, super easy. You know, like I'm probably not someone that's...
Well, one of the companies at Hewlett Packard, one of the divisions made workstations. And I don't know if they still offer workstations or not. I don't see those around much at all anymore. I'm sure there are some cases where you need one. But they were losing market share. And part of it was the reliability of the products they were offering. And so one of the things they did in their refreshed product is they put a door on the side of the box, is like a pizza box looking thing. And the motherboard fit into a socket. So the whole board plugged in. And so you open this little door, you open up two latches, and you can pull the entire motherboard out. And so if you have a failure, what HP did at that time is they said, okay, we know it's a bad motherboard. We're going to FedEx one to you. It'll be there tomorrow. Swap it out, put the old motherboard back in the bag and send it back to us. And then we'll give you, you know, it's part of the warranty or part of the service or whatever. Prior to that, it was so many cables and connections and everything else. It was just wired into the system that it had to be in the shop to be assembled correctly and verified that it was going to work. And so they redesigned it so that it was just a simple set of sockets on the end of the board that they shoved it in there, and it got rid of all of the technical overhead to actually repair it. When they realized that the importance of these mostly mechanical engineers running CAD programs or simulation engineers running high-end software, downtime was really expensive to them. And so... Mm-hmm. Redesigning it and charging them an extra $100 because of the redesign was well worth it. And customers that had the machines go down on them and they got to do the repair right on their desktop were very loyal after that, because nobody else offered anything at that time to make the repair and get your machine up and running again so easy. And so there's the right to repair, though, goes beyond that. It's like you and I being able to upgrade our operating system without it destroying half of our system, half of our everything else,
yes.
Or being down for 2 hours, or yeah. Or update the radio in the car, but just keep the thing running. You know, I mentioned the Microsoft 10 is dropping support for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the news last night, the show I was listening to, and they were estimating tens of millions of computers are going to head to the landfill, even though they're perfectly working units. But without the ongoing protection for spam and malicious attacks and all other stuff, they're not worth keeping online. And so people are going to either get taken over their computers, or they're going to just say this is too risky and they get rid of it. Yet they're still functional. They still do what people want them to do. And just losing software support is going to fill a landfill. And it was like tens of millions of machines they're expecting to be affected.
Wow. That's,
you know, and I'm quite sure there's
some,
if some organization, I'm thinking of all these open source type products, not open AI, but open source initiatives and works, there's probably 200 really talented programmers that'd love to get into the details of Microsoft 10 and keep it up to date. You know, they're not selling it anymore. Why would they care? But they're not going to release it.
Yeah. It also makes me wonder about the recyclability of those units. Like if they're going to go to wouldn't it be great if there was a system that it's like, okay, these units, you know, are for whatever reason, like in this case, you know, because the Windows 10 support is stopping, are going to go to, are not usable anymore. Wouldn't it be great if there was a system to collect those and then take them apart and recycle the materials? Because they would have a lot of materials in there that would be very useful.
Very useful. And there are e-waste reverse supply chains or paths to do that. It's expensive to extract it. And even just to get the gold out of it now, it's even at $4,000 an ounce, it's still expensive. It's not cost effective to go after all the separate metals and all the separate materials and components and so on. There is still some of that work. There used to be a store in the Bay Area that was, I want to call it Stranger Things, but I think that was a TV series.
Yes, it was.
it was a whole warehouse looking store, and it had like old Microsoft 10 boards or old, you know, sets of chips and memory boards and just anything you can think of, you know, vacuum tubes for old TV sets. It had everything in it. It was all, you know, scavenged stuff from recycled materials. It was a fascinating store, especially mm-hmm. when you needed weird things or weird stuff. I think it was what it was called, something like that. But there's many, many problems to it. The companies that are trying to sell you the new iPhone with the 8 bazillion mm-hmm. pixel camera are not interested in that, keeping your iPhone 1 still working. They're just not. So there's a conflict of interest there. And there's no real incentive for them to continue to do it. I think Europe's got some effort to, you know, divert stuff out of landfills and make it pretty expensive, that if you obsolete something, you have to pay for it to take it back. And I think there's a recycling fee when you buy electronics in the U.S. now that it's not. I think I bought a TV a couple of years ago, and it was $25 for the recycling fee. Like, that's not going to cover the cost of recycling that.
Mm. Yeah,
so there's a, we do have yes. a long way to go. It's a great idea. I fully support it. As a reliability person, we make stuff to last, and artificially obsoleting something is just crazy to me.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, agreed. But it was it's definitely, like you say, lots to go. And it's a great topic. And yeah, grateful to Jacob for bringing it up.
Yeah. Shout out to Jacob. Thanks so much for bringing it up. And hopefully this sparks another idea or two for you. You know, it works now. It might take us a little while to get it around to recording it and getting it on the air. Yet it's part of an ongoing discussion of which any of the listeners can participate in. So just let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there you can find a couple of different ways to get in touch with us. And Mojan and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our About pages. So plenty of ways for you to join the conversation. And we look forward to what you have to say. So with that, hopefully all of the equipment we're using continues to work, at least for another recording mm-hmm. session, maybe whenever we get back to doing that. I don't have to recycle anything or fix anything.
Well, I am one of the people who is impacted by the Windows 10 thing, so I have to figure out what I'm going to do.
Oh, no, you are.
Yes, I have to figure out. I really need to look into that. I should do that this weekend.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're just milking it as long as you can.
I mean, like I said, like my device is functioning just fine. So
right. Yeah. No. Well, good luck with that. Well, that might be another whole topic just to talk about that in general.
Experiences
with it. Yes. That'd be cool.
Yes.
All right. Cool. We'll talk to you soon. Take care now.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.